Thank you for joining us for this episode of Talking with Religious Historians. This is a short-form episode of our regular Ecclesiastical History Society podcast, wherein we talk to established religious historians to find out more about their careers and what advice they would give early career researchers. I'm your host, Dr. Emily Betts, a historian of early modern British medicine and religion. Thank you for joining us today. On today's episode, we welcome Professor Hilary Carey. Professor Carey is Professor of Imperial and Religious History at the University of Bristol. She specializes in the history of religion and imperialism, particularly within the transnational boundaries of the 19th century British Empire. Professor Carey's most recent book, Empire of Hell, published by Cambridge University Press in 2019, won the Kay Daniels Prize and provides a religious history of the campaign to end the transportation of British and Irish convicts. Her current projects include a collaborative history of missions to seamen and the history of the global Bible, the plan to translate the Bible into all the languages of the world. Welcome to the podcast, Professor Carey. Thank you for joining me today.
Hi there, Emily. I'm very happy to be here.
Oh, we're so excited that you can join us.
Thank you.
Your research focuses on the intersection of history of religion and imperialism. Can you tell us more about how you became interested in this field and what's exciting you about your research at the moment?
Yeah, thanks, Emily. So to be fair, I actually didn't start out as an imperial historian. I trained initially as a medievalist, though I've always been interested in religious history. In fact, the first piece I ever published was on devout literate lay people as reflected in evidence of wills and devotional literature in the 14th century. So I've had an interesting journey, if you like, from the world of the Middle Ages and devotional lay people then to the grand imperial conflicts of the 19th century. But this is my story. So I completed my doctorate in Oxford, and that was on a medieval topic. And then when I came back to Australia, by this time with a small child, I got lured into writing about religious history archives in Australia. And at that time, I was teetering on in the world of precarious employment, and there were one or two more babies who came along as well. And I discovered there was this wonderful world of religious history in the Australian colonies and also in the British colonies across the empire. And that's really how it happened, that there was a field and I had the right training and I was able to get engaged within it. So I started working on that, on things like missions to the Australian Aborigines, to histories of religious orders. I was very interested in missionary nuns, and I was absolutely fascinated by the first British missionary societies, which came out to Australia in the early days of settlement to work with the Australian Aborigines. And so I suppose that's really how it started. I was just so excited to be more or less the first person to be working through some of these archives. And if you've never had this experience, you know, walking into a church archive and just seeing piles of fascinating documents on the floor untouched, you're the first person who's had access to them since they were being used by the institution. It really is a very exciting moment. It was really as an outcome of my interest in missions that I veered into the history of missions to colonists. And that's the first book I wrote, which is God's Empire, which you've just mentioned.
Yeah, that's so interesting, that byline through your research, because really, starting out as a medievalist, you wouldn't think you would end up doing 19th century, and yet you've still been able to have such incredible access to archives and primary sources and find something that you love in both periods. That's just great.
Yeah, and I think that as ecclesiastical historians, as church historians, as religious historians, it's a not uncommon story. So, you know, you begin in an apostolic past, if you like. And the training that you learn in languages and in the use of archives and the importance of text, they are readily translatable into these very long-lived institutions that we're all fascinated by, the churches. And that's certainly been the case with me anyway.
That's wonderful. And right now you're part of two projects, as I mentioned in the introduction, and I just want to go a bit deeper and hear more about your role in them. And so could you tell us a bit about the Mariner's Religion, Race, and Empire in British Ports, 1801 to 1914 project?
Yeah, sure. So as I said, I started off being absolutely gripped by the institutional history of religion and the churches in the 19th century. And I also wrote about convict transportation. Now, convict transportation involves transport across oceans, at least it does for the British Empire. And as I was researching that book and working with the ministers of religion and the jail chaplain and the prison chaplains who were involved in transported convicts, I kept coming across stories about the sailors who were involved in those voyages as well. And often they came from the same class as the convicts that we're talking about, a working class community, and a community which explodes in importance following the ending of the Napoleonic Wars, you know, around the first decade, about 1815. So that's really how I got into wanting to write about the history of missions to seamen. And that's what this project's about. So this one, the Mariners, Religious, Mason Empire project, is funded by the Arts and Humanities Research Council for 3 years. And we're currently in the second year of that project. And I'm working on that with my wonderful colleague here at the University of Bristol, Sunita Mukherjee. And now this project is looking at religion, race, and empire through the lens of the missions which are conducted directly to this labouring class, the seamen. And there's two bits to it. So Sunita is leading the one on Lascars, which are South Asian seamen. And I'm doing the second strand, which is looking at British seamen. So the backstory here is that at the beginning of the 19th century, well, after the French Wars had ended anyway, the workforce, so this terribly important workforce of those who were keeping trading transport alive on vessels, was almost entirely British. And this involves both the coastal shipping networks, but also the overseas ones, which are, of course, much more fascinating, much more written about. But by the end of our period, and the project cuts off in 1914, at least a third of that workforce was no longer British and usually no longer Christian. They were by and large made up of a South Asian workforce who were called Lascars, but there were also Africans and Pacific Islanders and people from all over the world. So you get this rapid transformation of the character of the marine labour force. And we're looking at the missions created to really morally regulate them over that era.
What an interesting project. What kind of outputs are you expecting to have from this?
We're trying to do things in as innovative a way as possible. So although we've got the standard kind of scholarly outputs, chapters, books, articles, that kind of thing, which are, of course, wonderful. And that's our bread and butter. We're trained academics. We're also trying to do a few different things. So the first big output we've had is the Mariner's website. So that's up and running and it looks really stylish. We're very happy with Millipedia, who's the company who've done that for us. And that's built around stories. So you can follow threads down and look at particular individuals, or you can look at organizations like the Mission Seafarers, which is our project partner. And you can look also at some of the shipping companies who are involved as employers within those groups. Anyway, it's almost like a sort of edited online book, and you can go on a voyage within this website. So that's one output. And
what a good resource. This sounds great.
Yeah, I hope so. And we're also inviting people who might like to collaborate with us so that you can create a story and we'll curate it for you and give you some help putting it together. So we're working with that with some of our students. So that's the first thing, the Mariner's website. And the next thing we're doing is going to happen this year. So we're going to have a conference. And that conference is going to be here in Bristol at the famous SS Great Britain, which, as some of the people listening will know, was Isambard Kingdom Brunel's great invention, the first overseas passenger liner, pretty well. I've invited scholars from all over the world to come and talk, but also we're going to have some different things. We're going to have conversations between early career and more advanced scholars in their careers. We are going to have some walking tours. We're also going to invite some artists who've been involved in contemporary work with missions to seafarers to try to reflect on some of the sites where missions to seafarers were located. So shall I tell you a little bit about more about that?
Yes, that would be great. Please do.
Yeah, so missions to seamen are one of those types of missions which I think are not very well known, but they were really part of the home missionary movement, an attempt by particularly dissenters and evangelical Protestants, so there were Catholic ones as well, to rejuvenate the moral character of the merchant marine and other marine workers. And they're in every port. So our project partner, Missions to Seafarers, is still going strong, and it's highly globalized and highly internationalized now, but they're in 200 ports around the world. Now, we can't do 200 ports, so we're just trying to do four. And those four ports are all in Britain, but as part of our conference, we're hoping to bring people in to talk about others as well. And the four we're focusing on are Bristol, of course, because we're from Bristol, and Hull. And Hull is chosen because it's another fascinating port city, but also because the Hull History Centre holds the archive of the Missions to Seafarers. That's the Anglican Mission, who's our project partner, and is one of the world's largest marine charities. The other one is Liverpool, simply because Liverpool is and remains an extraordinarily important Atlantic port for Britain, and had a complex array of services for seaborne industry, as well as the missions that we're writing about. And the other one is London. Now, it's almost impossible to do London justice, but we have to do London because that's where the Strangers' Home, which was the residence and mission which was set up to try to support Lascars who were coming into the Port of London in increasing numbers throughout the 1840s, 50s and 60s. And the Strangers' Home in London was one of those places which was set up because, by and large, Lascars found it almost impossible to find accommodation because of racism within the other facilities set up to look after other types of seafarers. So there are four ports and our four case studies. So that's just the answer to what we're trying to do. We're trying to give our project some focus as well as depth.
That's really, really interesting. And I love that there's so much of a spread there, not only geographically, but then, like you mentioned before, there's such a spread of different partners and people coming in to help with this project. You mentioned artists, you mentioned students. I mean, this is amazing, and it must be quite a huge endeavor to undertake. So what are you learning from this? Do you have any advice for other people that are trying to put together such a big project? What kind of advice would you say?
Yes, I don't have any regrets about what we tried to do, because the only reason you want to do something like this is to make a real difference and change your field and to bring in as diverse people as possible. That I think that if you can't innovate, you know, well, you have to be able to do that as well. And increasingly, it's what our funders are looking for as well. That I think is, I'm not saying we need to justify humanities research, but I think it's important to be able to have a positive story to say, to tell, that it's not just going to be about you, a book with your name on it, stuck in a library somewhere. You have to be speaking to take the new knowledge you're creating out to people, and also to co-produce it with the marginalized and vulnerable workers who are your subject matter, which is certainly the case for our research project anyway, that merchant sailors were a very vulnerable workforce. They lived very tough lives. Their families were under great strain. So we're trying to give dignity to those stories and also to those who sought to reach out to them as well. So missions tend not to have a very good press these days. You know, they seem to be complicit with imperialism and colonialism, with racism. So we're not trying to whitewash any of those realities about the story of religious missions to the merchant marine, but just trying to get as many people telling the story as possible from their perspectives and give those different strands dignity. So to those who might be imagining they'd like to take on a project like this, you know, be brave. And I think funders are looking for people who've got this willingness to go those extra few steps to try to include more people in the narrative. And I think it's what ultimately academic scholarship should really be about. I've got practical advice I can give to people who want to try to apply for these things as well, because for every successful project which gets funded, of course, there might be a dozen or more, scores more sometimes, which didn't make it and would also have been worth funding. But this is one of the ones which did make it, and I do feel quite a big responsibility that we complete it well, and yeah, we tell Merchant Seaman's story as well as possible.
That's great. And I would love to hear the practical advice about putting together these projects.
Yeah, so I think the Sumita and I probably were working on it for up to a year. And we initially, I think, started off with a project which was going to be about something which, looking back, was probably quite boring, which was just to try to elevate the traditional histories of missions to seamen, which have tended so far to have been written by insider former missionaries themselves, to really not be engaging with the big new subjects in the new imperial history, particularly in relation to challenging subjects like race and class. Yeah, initially we thought, all right, we'll write a new history of missions to seamen, which will be more like a modern secularist approach to it. So that's where we started. But as we started working with the research development team here in Bristol, it was evident that it would need to be much more rigorous than that. So we then started reaching out to look for the right type of project partners. I think we were really fortunate that the archivist in the Hull History Centre, Claire Wetherill is her name, and full credit to her, she had only just finished a masterwork, which is cataloguing the full Missions to Seafarers catalogue. So we were lucky, I think, that we came at the right time with a project just as this wonderful new resource was coming online. So you do need a quality partner, whether or not that's a charity or an institution or a new archive. You know, you have to be bringing something new. Don't feel that your project can really be just a slight tweak to the old style of history. I think as well, you know, so find the right partners, give yourself the time to do it. I also think that the lesson we learned as we were writing is that you do need to ensure that there's equal parts to your project. So Sumita's background is in migration history, also had particular expertise in impact, developing research impact. You know, look out for people who've got these extra strengths, things that you don't have, and try and build them into the project. We also included this element of an oral history component. So we want to also interview Marine chaplains. We've got the cooperation of the Missions to Seafarers to undertake that work. So we did try to think of as many different ways that we could actually enrich our project. Now, all of this takes time. So don't be in a hurry. Make sure you've got the right project and really commit to it. So I think by the time we'd written our project and rewritten it and polished it, we were really just burning to get that ship onto the launch pads and write it. Because it is a big commitment if you get funded or if you don't. If you don't get funded, you know, you've got to bear with the disappointment and all that lost work and trying to repurpose it. So make sure you really want to do it. That's probably enough advice for now.
That's great advice. And I really appreciate that, because sometimes I think, especially for people who don't work in academia or aren't used to doing these kinds of projects, getting them started, it's hard to believe that it takes about a year, you know, or so to even get this application in. So that's just wonderful advice to take your time and really be gung-ho about your project. And you are not only on this project, by the way, you are also on another project about the Global Bible. I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about that for our audience as well.
So yes, it's Sod's law, really, that you apply and apply and you don't get funded. And then I got two in the same year, which are running concurrently. And I do love both of my projects, but I do feel stretched. But let me tell you about the other project. Okay, so this one is called Global Bible, British and German Bible Societies Translating Colonialism, 1800 to 1940. So it's another colonial era project. So it builds on my existing research and fascination with missionary activity by Europeans in Australia and elsewhere. And a little sideline I've had going, which is fascination with missionary linguistics, which is the efforts which were made by missionaries once they arrive in a raw new place, working with peoples who might not have even had a written language, to turn those languages into, to encode them, turn them into a written form. And what was often, you know, a high priority task, which was then to translate the Bible into their languages. So I have a collaborator on this one, Felicity Jens at the University of Münster. And Felicity and I have been working for many years on different aspects of missionary linguistics. And I became fascinated by the work of the British and Foreign Bible Society, which I've been going backwards and forwards to for many years in relation to my interest in missions to the Australian Aborigines. Now, that collection is in Cambridge University Library and is an extraordinary resource because there really is an ongoing project to try to translate the Bible into all the languages of the world. And this project really started getting going in the 19th century. It's not something which was really dreamed about prior to that. And we were also particularly interested, Felicity and I, in the way in which Germany was really the heartland of the discipline of philology and linguistics. The greatest linguists were all trained there. And the British and Foreign Bible Society used German linguists in its activity and to polish and check these new translations which were emerging from the field in the 19th century. So we got together and we thought we would have a project. So we put one up. This time it's to the Arts and Humanities Research Council and the German DFG, which is German Research Council. And Felicity is leading her side of the project in Münster with Michael Wondersom, who's the postdoc researcher working on the West African case study. And here in Bristol, I'm working on the other case studies, which are to do with Australia and the Arctic, with my postdoc, Floris Stolleveld. So we've got a team together, and we're also getting going on this project as well, which I can also feel passionate and enthusiastic about. But yeah, they're running concurrently.
That's great. I mean, really, the way that you've described these projects, you have such a global reach. I mean, you are looking at very widespread history here. And as somebody doing transnational history, do you feel like there's something, you know, any advice that you could give to others wanting to start on transnational historical research or anything that you knew sooner?
Managed to contain both projects by having a case study approach, and we've made that quite clear. So the Global Bible, although the attempt really to translate the Bible into all the languages of the world is extraordinary and fascinating, it's an artifact of human ambition. I think we said in the application, it's sort of like the humanities equivalent of the moonshot, what was really involved, because many of these languages didn't exist in written form. So the intellectual endeavor is just mind-blowing. But we're not trying to do all that. We're just trying to do four case studies. So although we're interested in what's happening globally, we're not interested in the whole globe, just those bits of it that together can make a coherent story. And this, I suppose, is where the imperialism comes in. So the possibility of doing these sorts of projects and looking at this wholly, at this extraordinarily mobile world, the world of seamen traveling the globe or of missionaries traveling the world, these are actually related phenomena. They come out of the way in which European empires planted themselves across the globe and throughout the 19th century, culminating in gross imbalances in power and knowledge, but also meaning that we're now all connected together. So studying it from the point of view of the marine workforce and the Global Bible movement is really looking through a particular lens at movements which created our modern world.
It's really fascinating work. And I think that is a very interesting way to say that it is, you know, these different lenses on the same overall phenomenon. And you are really helping us to understand imperialism a lot better through both of these projects. So I really appreciate you taking the time to come and tell us about them today. I have one final question for you, if that's okay.
Sure, fire away.
What is your favorite part of being an academic?
My favorite part of being an academic, can I give two answers?
Of course, yes.
Well, I think my favorite part of academic, as far as the teaching is concerned, is certainly working with students and seeing them develop new projects and new ideas. So at the moment I'm teaching on a course called Global Empires, strangely enough. And we've just given those students a wonderful project to do where they had to pitch a trade book. And I don't usually say I like marking. I don't like marking. That wouldn't be true. But I do feel enormously uplifted by the sorts of wonderful, smart ideas that students have come up with. with on this project about these trade books on global empires. So I love working with my students, that's the first thing. And the second thing I love more than anything else is the thing I hinted at the beginning, what got me into this game right at the beginning, which is walking into an archive and just saying, what am I going to find next? What am I going to discover about people who lived in the past, and how can I uncover their worlds? That's what I love about being an academic.
Great answers. It is so fun to go and play detective and really get to find out about a whole other world. So thank you so much. It was just such a pleasure having you on today's episode, Professor Carey. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for talking to me, Emily. It's been a pleasure too.